This call is being recorded by the meeting organizer. By staying on the call, you are giving your consent to being recorded.
Okay, Kim, the floor is yours.
Thank you. So, hi everyone. As Johnny said, my name is Kim. I'm from one of the attorneys from the Third Circuit. And I will be talking to you all about master trust accounts and Social Security. So to start out, a master trust account is a legal trust document, and it's something that's created to manage and protect the funds that are received by DCF for children in foster care. There's several little sub-accounts that make up the master trust account, and those cover things like the child's current needs and long-term needs, any plan for achieving self-sufficiency later on in life, and as far as establishing them as an adult in that role, and also for funds for disabled children. So things like their special needs, any lump sum of SSI distribution, and Medicaid income trust. So there's several different funds that can go into a master trust account. The most common is Social Security funds, but basically it's any funds that are not earned by the child directly. So something like if the child is employed and they have, if they are earning their own salary, that wouldn't go into a master trust account. That would be more so a bank account. But any other funds that the child accrues indirectly would likely go into the master trust. So some of the funds, as I stated, come from Social Security, and that can come in the form of SSI, Supplemental Security Income, which is a need-based benefit for the children or for adults with disabilities, and it has a $2,000 balance limit, and once that limit is reached, the payments will stop. So you don't want it to go, once it starts getting close to that, it needs to be monitored to see, if the children have any current needs where they can withdraw from that, because once you hit that $2,000 limit, you're stuck there. And then it may also impact the child's Medicaid. There's also just other benefits from Social Security, just the SSA, the Social Security Administration. Those are things like survivor benefits, benefits for retired or disabled parents and stuff of that nature. Those are based strictly on the parents' earnings. And like I said, it also includes death benefits. Other possible sources could be things like inheritance, life insurance, and just if they have lawsuits against anybody, any company, anything of that nature, where they've received an earning from that. So to go a little more in depth with the Social Security funds, the Social Security dependent benefits are from when the children have a parent who is disabled, deceased, or retired. And that's something where, like, if the parent's getting with the disability, the SSDI, the parent has had to have worked enough to qualify for the benefit. So they have had to been, they have work credits they have to accrue. They have to be able to have made enough money that they have been paying in that they can, something where the parent would be eligible to withdraw this money. So the children can get up to 50% of that amount that the parent would be entitled to if the parent is disabled or retired, and they can get up to 75% if the parent is deceased. There's something in here that I went ahead and added. It's called Social Security Benefits for Disabled Young Adults. It's often referred to as adult child. It's something that is an extension. Obviously, our cases generally only go through when the child turns 18, the court relinquishes jurisdiction, and we're not as much involved with the children, or at that point the young adults. But this is something where if the child was disabled before he or she turns 18, that the benefits they were receiving before will continue on so long as the person is disabled. So then the disabled child can collect the SSDI, you know, as long as the, you know, the parent is still entitled to, or if the child is still entitled to the funds that they previously were. There's also supplemental security income, which would be SSI, and this is when the child is disabled and the household income qualifies. Now, that'll be based on the child's placement. So it'll be, you know, the caregiver household income, or if the child's reunified with the parents, it would be then, you know, the parents' income. But the Social Security has defined disabled as a child who is not earning more than $1,130 a month, and the child must have a physical or mental condition or a combination of conditions that result in marked and severe functional limitation. And the condition must seriously limit the child's activities and must be long-term. When they discuss long-term, they're basically just saying that it's expected to either their condition is expected to result in death or it's continuous for more than 12 months. And if a child is in a medical facility where insurance is paying for it, that amount's going to be limited to $30 a month that they get. And if it's something where you're dealing with a case where there's a child in a facility and then they leave the facility, Social Security needs to be notified, because although generally the department should notify, they don't always, and it's something where they're not going to know unless somebody notifies them. And, you know, the children at that point might be entitled to more than the $30, however much they would be based on the income of where they're at. And for some medical conditions, the federal government will go ahead and make SSI payments while the state is still deciding whether the child would qualify. This is generally for severe conditions where the federal government basically assumes that it's so severe that there's no way that the state is going to deny the child's disability. So sometimes the federal government will step in and go ahead and immediately make those payments while the state is still determining. So that is shorthand the Social Security funds that go into a master trust account. So when we get to monitoring the master trust, when you look at every judicial review report that the department files, if the child has a master trust, the department has to include the balance of the trust funds, a copy of the account statement, which is really just all the money in, all the money out of the account, and a fee waiver application. The monthly summary of the amounts of the money in the current trust funds is sent out, and if there is an expenditure from the child's funds that is either $500 or more, then the parents have to be informed if their rights are still intact, the guardian ad litem, and then if the child has an attorney, they all need to be notified of the expenditure. When it comes to paying the board rate, there's a legal presumption that the department can use the master trust funds to pay for the child's board. Prior to paying the board rate, a monthly allowance is set aside. Generally, that's about $30. And fee waivers allow for the waiver of board rate so that the money does not come out of the child's master trust account, and it can be applied by, you know, the fee waiver can be applied for by any interested party, which would include the guardian ad litem program. When it comes to using the money, the money should be withdrawn to meet the needs, the current needs of the child. The amount of money withdrawn shall take into account the need of the department and the agencies as the trustee of the client's money and property to provide for the long-term needs of the client, including things like ensuring that They'll have the resources when they turn 18, if they have any special needs, any disability, anything to go to, you know, providing care for that, providing some stability for the child, and, you know, if there's any kind of public assistance that's needed, and just any other, you know, physical, emotional, medical needs that the child needs under Florida state law, any of that, the money can be used for any of those things. And if you'll see some examples, that, you know, they have the Department of Social Security, they've mapped out, or mostly the department, they've mapped out current needs and long-term needs. So things like room and board, if they're in a residential facility, the medical, psychological, psychiatric, or dental treatment that Medicaid doesn't cover, because there are some things that, as you know, Medicaid doesn't cover fully. Personal comfort items, they list television, tape player, alarm clock, books, anything transportation-wise, getting to and from work and school activities, and then things of lawn care needs would be educational, or if they do vocational needs, anything like tuition, books, equipment, trying to prepare for either for school or for the job site, and any kind of independent living expenses if the child is at that stage where they are, where they need the services. And then once the child turns 18 and absent a disability, they're entitled to receive the remaining trust funds in their account. And that's going to come out as a lump sum. It's not going to be, basically, once they turn 18, everything that's there is theirs to do with what they please, unless they have a disability that would prevent them from handling their own finances. And then it's something where if a guardian advocate is appointed, then the funds would go to the guardian advocate to be able to distribute as needed and as deemed fit, and that's all under the Regis Little Act. As far as Master Trust, that's about all I have. There are some handouts detailing more about Social Security, because it's such a intense and in-depth concept. The first handout is the Social Security Disability and SSI for Children. It goes through, it lists the basic requirements for disability, the income and assets, the listing of impairments, and it does list some of the conditions that may be eligible for automatic approval, things like asthma, HIV, mental retardation, sickle cell disease, cystic fibrosis, autism, and ADHD, and these are as listed by Social Security. It'll go through things that, you know, might not meet a listing, and just other questions as far as the reviews, and it does have a blurb about the SSDI for adult children, which is what we discussed, where the benefits will continue after they're 18, with if they've had the pre-existing disability. The other handout is Supplemental Security Income for Children and Youth with Disabilities, and it's from the Council on Children with Disabilities, and it goes through more in depth with the difference between SSI and SSDI, and again, the eligibility, the benefits, the actual application process, how you go forward, how the eligibility is determined, whether it's presumptive or whether there is an actual separate determination made. And it'll go through the evaluation, the role of having a doctor do an evaluation, any kind of further recommendations and things of that nature. So with that, I don't think I have further.
All right, is anybody out there that might have any questions? Thank you, Kim.
This is Tom Turcotte from the Seventh Circuit. I've got maybe a clarifier and some advice, and then I have a question.
Okay.
As far as the input, I suppose you could call it, when I heard about the funds being turned over to a child who turns 18 without a disability, I agree that that's what's supposed to happen. The problem is that Social Security, you may find some of your circuits, will indicate that no, the money has to go back to Social Security first, and then Social Security will subsequently return the money to the child, which creates an unnecessary delay. That's what Social Security will say, I think, in a lot of your circuits, and your community-based care providers might go along with that. So what you might need is a court order ordering the release of the funds directly to the child, and then CPC or whatever your community-based care group might be should honor that. Now, because SSA's rules say the child is going, the money's supposed to go back to SSA, you may need case law or statute to support you. And there's a case, DCF versus RG 950, Southern 2nd 497, Florida 5th DCA 2007, which does indicate that the money has to go to the child instead of being returned to SSA, even though SSA will say it to the contrary. So that's an important issue, I think, that you might want to keep in mind.
Thank you, Tom.
And then
thank
now
you.
You're welcome. Now, the question I have is, recently ABLE accounts become a much more bigger topic. They were in a disability someone I went to, I think, either a year or two ago, and they just recently became authorized to be used in Florida in the last couple of years, from what I understand. And I don't know how many of you are familiar with them, but they can be very useful because they can help effectively shelter a child's funds for future use that would not count against the $2,000 Social Security limit. That's what it boils down to. I mean, it's probably its own training in its own right, but basically a disabled child can put up to either $14,000 or $15,000 a year into this account. And then basically the ability to use the account is quite broad, what they can use it for later in life. And it seems like it should be used a lot by dependent children who have SSI income because it does not require them to keep trying to spend down the $2,000. Instead, they can accrue it. However, the problem is that we recently had this come up in our circuit, and CPC is challenging it, and they're saying that because the money has to stay in the master trust until it's spent effectively, that they can't take the money out and put it in a master trust, even though there's a court order that they need to. So I'm just curious whether any other circuits has dealt with this or not yet, and how they've handled that, the somewhat conflict between the master trust requirements and the ABLE accounts.
Second, I have a question. Are there requirements for the fee waiver?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that. Can you repeat that, please?
Yes. You say that you could do a fee waiver for the board rate. Are there certain requirements, or can you do that on any case and just request a fee waiver? Is there going to be pushback from the CBCs about that?
That I'm not sure about. There can always be pushback from CBCs, but as far I believe it can be done, but I will look into it further and let you guys know. I haven't heard of it coming up, but as far as a place where you couldn't request it, but again, I'm not 100% sure, so I'll look into it some more and get some information out to Donnie and get it to everyone.
This is John Papacek in Lake County. My CBC, Kids Central Incorporated, generally would want it as part of a case plan. An example I can give is, let's say you have a child reaching 18 and they'll need the money for when they turn 18. And if you can put it in the case plan, as part of their transition to 18, then they'll go along with the fee waiver. So my answer is, it's my CBC doesn't so much give a pushback as much as you have to have some justification for the fee waiver.
There's a administrative code that governs fee waivers, at least as of the last time I did a training on this. I don't know if it's changed or not, but 65C-17.005 governs fee waivers, so that probably is a lot of information for you.
Yeah,
thanks, Tom.
You're welcome.
I'm sorry.
Just real quick, Donnie, sorry. I wanted to say thanks to Tom, too, for the question he asked. And the fact that none of us were jumping in talking about, I love the ABLE accounts, and I have to admit that I don't have a lot of knowledge about them. But we have Travis Fincham coming back again this year to our disabilities conference to talk about those, and that's something that I definitely want to get more knowledge. And I know Donnie just sent out a resource for us, but and Kim, thank you.